Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We're going to be talking today about the Book of Daniel, the NBC drama that aired in a two-hour premiere on Friday night last week. And I did not want us to talk about it until we had actually seen it, had an opportunity to talk about it in an informed way. There was a lot of preliminary media coverage and controversy about it, but now at least many of you have seen it. And if not, you know what the show is about. We're going to be talking about not only the program, the Book of Daniel, but we're going to be talking about what we really expect out of television and what we should expect out of that medium and what it means when, for instance, here you have writers and producers who are attempting to put together what they think, I mean, or at least they say they think, is a realistic portrayal of religion in America. In this case, situated within a wealthy New York suburban community in an Episcopal church and in the household of the Episcopal priest. We'll be talking about that in the main segment of the program coming up in just a moment. First of all, the big news out of Washington, D.C. is the opening of confirmation hearings for Judge Samuel L. Alito before the Judiciary Committee of the United States Senate. And as expected, there were a lot of fireworks this morning, and you can expect these hearings to go on for the remainder of this week. Let me just point out that as Christians, we have a lot of interest in this. But one of the main interests we have has to do with the role of the judge and with the authority of a text. Because when we're talking about the text of the United States Constitution and we're talking about the role of the judge as interpreter, we're talking about an engagement with a text, a relationship to the authority of a text that is not the same but is parallel to the responsibility of the believer with the Word of God. Is the text the meaning or do we bring the meaning? Is the text the authority, or does the judge serve as the authority? Interesting questions, and I think over the next week we're going to be hearing a lot going back and forth. There is an essential political dimension to this. There's just no getting past it. But while we talk about what to listen for and what's going on, let's listen to Judge Alito in his opening comment about the role of a judge.
When I became a judge, I stopped being a practicing attorney, and that was the big change in role. The role of a practicing attorney is to achieve a desirable result for the client in the particular case at hand. But a judge can't think that way. A judge can't have any agenda. A judge can't have any preferred outcome in any particular case. And a judge certainly doesn't have a client. The judge's only obligation, and it's a solemn obligation, is to the rule of law.
A very good statement there. And one of the things I appreciate about Judge Alito is he just is who he is. I mean, here you have, this boy who grew up in an Italian family and went to law school and created for himself a distinguished career in the law. Here you have him explaining just the way he would speak if he were functioning as he has done for many years as a federal judge and as one who would teach about what a judge does. One other issue here is the rule of law. That's where Judge Alito pointed as the bottom line issue. Let's listen as Judge Alito speaks about the rule of law.
And there is nothing that is more important for our republic than the rule of law. No person in this country, no matter how high or powerful, is above the law, and no person in this country is beneath the law.
Okay, let me just be ruthlessly honest here for a moment with you. I think you can expect to virtually anyone of any ideological position and any kind of judicial background and any kind of political philosophy to say essentially those same words. I think if you just take those words out, you will find a very similar statement made by anyone who has ever come before the Judiciary Committee of the United States Senate for confirmation. And I think the reason is this. We talk about the rule of law. We speak about being a nation which is of laws, not of men. That is, it's not individual authority. It's the authority of the law on behalf of the people. But when you talk about the rule of law, it's one thing to say that you believe it. It's another thing to talk about how that is actually translated into what a judge does and how a judge rules in any given case. And in particular, it goes back to the issue, is the law some kind of evolving a body of interpretation that the judges create, Or is it a fixed reality that is established in a document such as the U.S. Constitution and then the derivative laws and statutes from that? And is it the judge's responsibility and purpose to interpret that law or to continue to evolve or to progress the development of the law in some kind of new direction? That is the fundamental issue here. I don't even know if these confirmation hearings are going to make that clear, but it's clear in my mind that that's the big issue. But as you listen, be listening for the statements being made by not only Judge Alito, but by senators on both sides of the aisle about what they are looking for here. And you can always count on some being ready for bombast, and that was certainly the case with Senator Charles Schumer of New York when he was speaking to Judge Alito. But, of course, the TV cameras were on. He was really speaking to the country.
While every Supreme Court nominee has a great burden, yours, Judge Alito, is triply high. First, because you've been named to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, the pivotal swing vote on a divided court. Second, because you seem to have been picked to placate the extreme right wing after the hasty withdrawal of Harriet Myers. And finally, and most importantly, because your record of opinions and statements on a number of critical constitutional questions seems quite extreme.
Okay, just a little key to political interpretation. Number one, the minority party is usually the party to use this kind of rhetoric. And it's because the party in power is the party making the nominations and proposing the legislation and all the rest. So when you are making a nomination, you present the nominee, of course, in the most favorable light. That's why you chose the person, and here's what you want the nation to know about it. Well, in response, what you get is this kind of rhetoric, and in this case, it's the Democrats with Senator Schumer saying, well, for instance, in the brief expanse there of 31 seconds, he used the word extreme twice. He said about Judge Alito, you seem to have been picked to placate the extreme right wing. What's the extreme right wing? It's pretty much like at least half of America that elected George W. Bush with this very concern. And let's just pass on beyond that. And then he finished by saying, and finally, most importantly, because of your record of opinions and statements on a number of critical constitutional questions, seems quite extreme. Now, what's really interesting is that this is the same judge who not that long ago was up for confirmation for the Federal Appeals Court, and these same senators, this same committee, seemed not to find it so extreme. So what you're really talking about here is a political posturing going on to try to use the word extreme. You're going to see it over and over again. The New York Times this morning in its lead editorial used the word extreme. And, you know, it's one of those words you can get away with if you're allowed to, because you don't have to define what in the world you're talking about. What they're talking about here is that Judge Alito is on the record as saying that he believes the Constitution is a fixed document and that it is the judge's rule to interpret and not to revise or to progressively interpret the Constitution to mean something other than what it does mean. Well, let's also hear what some others had to say. And in particular, I think it's worth paying attention to what Senator Dianne Feinstein said about her concern about a woman's right to choose. This is a little long, but you need to hear it because this was a manifesto offered by California's senior senator.
I'm also concerned with the impact you could have on women's rights, and specifically a woman's right to choose. In the 33 years since Roe was decided, there have been 38 occasions on which Roe has been taken up by the court. The court has not only declined to overrule Roe, but it has also explicitly reaffirmed its central holding. In our private meeting, when we spoke about Roe and precedent, you stated that you could not think of a case that's been reviewed or challenged more than Roe. You also stated that you believe that the Constitution does provide a right of privacy, and that you have a deep respect for precedent. However, in 1985, you clearly stated that you believed Roe should be overturned and that the Constitution does not protect a woman's right to choose. So despite voting to sustain Roe on the Third Circuit, your opinions also raise questions about how you might rule if not bound by precedent. And, of course, obviously, I'd like to find that out.
Well, there you had a very clear statement being made by Senator Feinstein. Here's what I want. I want an affirmation from Judge Alito. This is what I demand, she says. An affirmation from Judge Alito that he will not in any way overturn Roe versus Wade or question in any way in his role as a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court what she characterizes as a woman's right to an abortion. Now, what's really interesting is that when you look at the founding documents of this country and you consider the Senate's responsibility, in almost all previous cases, there's been an understanding that this is precisely the kind of question which should not be asked. But in one sense, all the rules are off. It's going to be fascinating to see what comes out of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and we'll be watching it along with you. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the Book of Daniel. Just what do we expect out of television anyway? This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I just found out at the break that we had some technical difficulties. So if you joined us right in the middle of that last segment, just understand the problem's not on your end. It had to do with getting the program up on the national feed for the network. But anyway, these things sometimes happen. This is technology. Sometimes it works. Generally, it works. And let's be thankful for that. But when it doesn't, well, you just found out like I did that you were talking to yourself for a few minutes. But that's all right. I was informing myself. But now it's time for us to talk together. And we're going to shift gears and be talking about the NBC program, The Book of Daniel. And you know, my first thought is that I agree with a reviewer from the Wall Street Journal I read who said, the Episcopal Church, even the Episcopal Church doesn't deserve this. And I think in one sense, that's kind of the bottom line. But what we have here on Friday night last week was a two-hour pilot for what is proposed to be an ongoing NBC drama. It's entitled The Book of Daniel, and it is situated as a drama in a suburban New York community where there is an Episcopal priest by the name of Daniel Webster. Don't you know they must have stayed up all night coming up with that name? And then the family of this man and the parish and the church and the denomination and the whole thing, you've got bishops who are morally compromised. You have a pill-popping, Vicodin-dependent priest who has a gay son whom they're encouraging to find the right guy. And then he has another adopted teenage son who's having sex with the daughter of the church's warden. And the question is whom having sex with whom? It's really just going on in this whole thing. You've got embezzlement. You've got the minister's daughter being arrested for drug possession and selling. And you just have all this going on. And this is what the network, NBC, I'm going to place the blame solidly on NBC. They're the ones who are broadcasting this program. NBC somehow thinks this is what you're looking for. That this is going to be the next big hot item like supposedly Desperate Housewives and so many others. Diane Winston, writing in the Los Angeles Times, says that this is not an attack upon Bible-believing Christians. Well, you know, she's somewhat right about that. I mean, in a weird way, she's almost accurate because the people being portrayed on this program are not what I would characterize as Bible-believing Christians. This is a very, very liberal Episcopal priest. And by the way, the producer said they were looking for a priest when they were writing this. They decided they would make it an Episcopal priest because they wanted all the theatrics and the smells and the candles and the vestments of Catholicism, but they wanted the guy to be married. Now, the Catholics are upset about this particular program because it appears to present the Catholic Church as something like a front for the mafia. The Episcopalians are upset about it because even as they're in all kinds of trouble and have elected an openly gay bishop of New Hampshire and other things, you know, just to be honest, I don't think there's an Episcopal priest in America who has enough time to get into this much trouble. And now, I'm upset about it as I think about it, because I just see this as the kind of evidence of what's going on with the whole Hollywood culture, the entertainment culture, and what it does when it takes any kind of topic, but especially a topic of Christianity, and tries to make of it a drama for entertainment. And I forgot one other character in the whole program, of course, and that is Jesus, who appears as a very benign, non-threatening, and generally non-judgmental kind of hippie who, as one observer says, looks like he belongs in a grunge band. But the thing that I noticed as I was watching the thing is that he's a very effeminate character as well. Well, I think as we get ready to talk about this, number one, I want you to get ready to call. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-8255. 1-800-293-TALK. I'd like especially to hear from folks who saw the program. I want to know what you're thinking of it. And the big issue is not just are we angry about this, but what do you think this means? What do you think this tells us about the entertainment culture? And one of the questions I want to raise is what this actually tells us about television and what we should expect when something like this is made into an ongoing drama. Time magazine had a big article on this entitled That Prime Time Religion. And James Pleniwzik, who is the author, the reporter of this particular article, just points out in an interview with Brenda Hampton, who's one of the creators of the show, that the creators decided they had to come up with all of these different storylines about embezzlement and homosexuality and premarital sex and just on and on and on, Vicodin popping priests and all the rest, because they said, the conservative Christianity wouldn't be that interesting. Quoting Barbara Hampton, she said, "How do you promote this week Ruthie respects her parents?" Well, I can chuckle at that. But, you know, it does tell you something that here you have one of the creators of the program saying we have to have this kind of storyline because who wants to see a happy family with good relationships, doing the things that are rightly ordered? That's not interesting. Well, did you find the program interesting? Let's listen to a couple of clips from it because some of this is really interesting. And this first clip is going to be long. In fact, it's right at 1 minute long. But to set it up, here is Pastor Daniel Webster preaching his sermon just after his daughter was arrested for selling marijuana. And you got to hear what he said in the pulpit.
Temptation. Is it really a bad thing? I don't think so. What I mean is, if there were no temptation, how could there be redemption? If we never did anything bad, how could we repent and be stronger for our weaknesses? Doesn't good need evil in order to be good? Now, obviously, I'm not suggesting that we should go looking for temptation, but my brothers and sisters, if temptation corners us, maybe we shouldn't beat ourselves up for giving into it. And maybe we shouldn't ask for forgiveness from a church or from God or from Jesus or from anyone until we can first learn to forgive ourselves.
Okay, I'm taking the nausea medication. That is about as clear a distillation of the most wretched liberal theology I have ever heard in my life. You know, it's no wonder the producers say this is not a mockery of Bible-believing Christianity. There's no Bible-believing Christianity to be found anywhere here. I mean, first of all, you have the pastor here, after his daughter was arrested for selling marijuana, coming out and celebrating temptation. Saying if we never did anything bad, how we would repent and be stronger for our weaknesses. Well, maybe he needs to read the book of Romans where Paul says, if as sin abounds, so grace much more abounds, should we then sin more that there would be more grace? And he says, by no means. God forbid that we would ever use that kind of logic. And then when he says maybe we shouldn't beat ourselves up for giving into temptation, what about where the Bible says there is no temptation given to us that is greater than we can bear? What about the model of Jesus, who, according to the book of Hebrews, was tempted in every way as are we, yet without sin? The Jesus who appears in the book of Daniel doesn't appear to have a whole lot of hang-ups about judgmentalism. He's kind of a modern Rogerian therapist. As a matter of fact, the strongest words of condemnation in this entire two-hour series were towards the pastor for popping the Vicodin, and that was rather mild. It really has very little to do with the embezzlement and the adultery and the homosexuality and the premarital sex and good grief. I'd have a hard time even keeping track of this. Oh, and by the way, don't you love the way the pastor ended his sermon by saying maybe we need to forgive ourselves? Well, you know, that's one thing the Bible doesn't even contemplate is forgiving ourselves. Sin is not something we do that disappoints ourselves. It is a violation of the glory of God. And it's God's forgiveness we need. Well, did you see the book of Daniel? And are you ready to talk about it? And what do we expect out of television anyway? Were we expecting Ruthie obeying her parents? The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK, coast to coast. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking about NBC's pilot last Friday night, the Book of Daniel. They're hoping it's going to be a wild success, but it's not starting out that way. According to Reuters, it came in third out of three in terms of ratings for Friday night. I find a little encouragement in that. But we're going to be talking in just a minute about what television is as a medium and how these shows actually get on the screen and what we should expect realistically out of television, especially when it comes to a drama, an ongoing drama like this. Immediately what comes to my mind is the work of someone like Neil Postman in his book Amusing Ourselves to Death. We are a society that wants to be entertained, and television is primarily about entertainment, not information. And those who are creating it, they also have their own worldview and ideologies. Those who are writing these programs are overwhelmingly more liberal and more secular than the Americans who are watching. And that's one of the reasons you have this disconnect. You have all these writers and producers and directors that, who think they've got a winner here, and it just doesn't go over in America. There's a lot of kickback from this program, a lot of controversy, and now we're going to go to the phones. The phone number, by the way, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Dave calling from Tampa, Florida, listening on WTBN. Dave, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Mohler. Basically, what we see here is this is what happens when The Passion of the Christ makes as much money as it does, and Hollywood sits up and takes notice and says there's got to be a way for us to market something to the Christian community so we can make money from it. And unfortunately, this is their twisted idea of marketing to Christians.
Okay, Dave, when you heard about this program, the Book of Daniel, and maybe you even had a brief synopsis of it, is this pretty much what you expected realistically out of Hollywood?
Absolutely. I mean, because, I mean, they just don't get it. You know, I think the last time that that Hollywood delved into theology, we got The Last Temptation of Christ. So, I mean, you know, they're just on another planet. Instead of calling them Hollywood, we should call them the People's Republic of Hollywood, because there's nothing Christian or American about that place, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, we certainly have learned to be very careful about the product that comes out there. I appreciate your call, Dave. You know, one of the things that that I think comes to mind when we think about the kind of storyline here, let's just imagine for a moment the great books of literature. You know, you talk about Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, Turgenev, Fathers and Sons, and you think about Dickens even in Victorian England, Shakespeare, and all of these great, great authors, Edith Wharton, and you think about what's really going on in their stories, in their novels in particular. Well, there is always a moral crisis. As a matter of fact, the story isn't interesting without a moral crisis. And we really do want realism in the characters. We want characters who are real people if we're going to understand them. And we do have a fascination with those who are, if anything, extraordinarily morally corrupt or extraordinarily violent or evil. There's always been a fascination with such characters. But when you move to television and you take Christianity as the background theme and you introduce Jesus as a character and then you pander to the most extreme understandings of the moral crisis and you portray people as involved in virtually everything. I mean, you have the entire catalog. I think that's what's in so many ways fascinating about this. It's as if they got down and said, let's think of every sin we could possibly think of that's most salacious and most sensational, and let's put them all in one family, okay? In one family. Now, there are some messed up families out there, and there are families that have family members involved in all kinds of things, but, you know, most families wouldn't even have the energy or the opportunity to come up with this much, much less in the very interesting and theatrical setting of an Episcopal priest's home. Now, I mentioned earlier the Time story in which some of the creators of this program spoke about why the Episcopal priest. Let me come back. It says they said that they picked an Episcopal priest because, like Catholic clergy, they have all that pageantry and mystery and wonder, but they can get married. That hasn't solved their problem, has it? Not according to this program. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Sari calling from Craig, Colorado, listening on XM Satellite Radio 170. Sari, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mohler. I was just incensed with this program. I think the only thing that they were truly lacking was another daughter who was serving in Iraq, who was captured, raped, and impregnated and was trying to decide between aborting her child and leaving the army that she loves. Other than that, I think they covered every base possible. It was just incredible.
Well, Sari, something tells me if they're listening to this program, something I'm not counting on, they may have a new storyline there. You may just have given them. And, you know, that is interesting. You know, there are many things coming out there. I had a Hollywood insider tell me in the last few hours that one of the developing story themes, if this thing goes forward, is that the gay son may actually fall in love with a girl, and his parents will talk him into, no, claiming his inner self as actually being gay and just being at peace with that. When we come back, we're going to hear what these parents in the pilot did say to their son that just might point in that direction. Coast to Coast, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We're talking about the Book of Daniel. NBC's two-hour pilot was Friday night. A lot of attention out there, and I really wanted to track the conversation over the weekend to see if it was worth devoting our hour to it today. And I decided it was because of the bigger picture. And I want to come back and say, I don't think for a moment that this is an attack upon conservative Christianity. Or if it was intended to be so, it is the greatest miscalculation by people who are completely incompetent at creating such a conspiracy. No, I prefer to see it as a satire on liberal Christianity. That's the way I see it. It's kind of a send-up of liberal Protestantism. You know, just listen to this guy talk. And didn't you love that sermon where it began? What would it be like if your preacher on Sunday morning had that kind of melodramatic soundtrack behind him as he preaches? And what if he spoke so slowly? God loves us. And you just add the symphony behind it and all the rest. That's not what I heard, and that's not what I did on Sunday morning. Something completely different than that, I can guarantee you. But it all comes back again to the basic theological understanding, the basic doctrinal core and framework that we believe Christianity represents. And if you were coming up with a satire on liberal Christianity, I don't think you could do much better than this. That's not to say I appreciate it, and I want to be very clear about my criticism of this program. I think NBC's decision to do this is an act of corporate irresponsibility, but I think since they have done it, it's worthy of our consideration in terms of what this means, not only about this program, but about television itself. But before moving to that issue, I want you to hear a segment, and this again is a fairly long segment, it's 43 seconds long, just get ready, in which you have the two parents here, you have Peter and Judith Webster talking to their gay son Peter about his gayness. This is clip number 12, guys.
Peter, there's no one left in the shaker.
No, thanks. I'm driving into the city to meet Tim.
Is Tim also, you know?
No, he's just a study partner.
Well, I never liked Josh. You're well out of that one.
Oh, you'll meet someone else. Maybe a male nurse or something. Well, knows what I mean. I love you, Dad.
Oh, when you do meet someone, dear, I'm sure he'll at least be a doctor or a surgeon. After all, you're young, you're good-looking, and well-off. There's no need to settle.
Thanks, Mom.
Night.
Good night, son.
Okay, resist the temptation to laugh at that. And just think seriously for a moment about what it would mean for Christian parents to give that kind of advice to a son struggling with the issue of homosexuality. I mean, if you were listening, what they said is, you're good looking, you're young, you should have options. The father suggests maybe you should find someone like a male nurse, and the mom comes back and says, no, you should aim higher, a doctor or a surgeon. It's about class here. It's about income and social status here. It's not about morality. But, of course, maybe he's been listening to his father preach, the same father who said maybe when temptation comes along, rather than resist it, you should give in to it, which is exactly what this son's doing. How can this priest, this Episcopalian preacher, have any questions about what his family's up to, including the teenage son having sex with the warden's daughter in the back of the car and all the rest? How can he? He just told them to do so. It's an act of self-exploration and self-development. Now, I don't know the producers and the writers, the creators of this program. All I know is what they've said in terms of their public comments. And I know the background of what's going on in Hollywood, at least in general terms. You know, this story makes sense to someone. And one question we should ask when we look at this program is, to whom does this make sense? Who looked at this and said, this is a plausible story? Who looked at this and said, I think people are going to want to watch that? You see, television is a medium that is flat. You're looking at it on a screen. It doesn't allow the kind of deep moral investigation that you would find in a novel. And frankly, it comes up far short of even what you can do in a major theatrical production or a Hollywood movie. But also, they have to hook you to come back next time. And they have to hook you when they go to commercials and they want you to be there when they come back. And so you have sensationalism piled upon sensationalism. Television can do a few things very well, but it does very few things very well. When there's a major event happening in the world, you can watch it on television, and that's a very satisfying experience compared to just hearing it. You know, whether it's the president speaking or you're watching coverage of some great world occurrence, television, frankly, can do humor fairly well because you don't have to be deeply invested in the story. That's why sitcoms are often so popular. I'm not saying they always do them well or they are always morally appropriate, but at least the medium of television can handle humor because you can laugh and you can turn it off and go on with your life. But where I think television comes up really short is in trying to be meaningful. Because when television tries to be meaningful, they have to say, your entire existence and the future of the world depends upon this issue, this question, this decision. Now stay tuned while we go to the laxative commercial, and we'll be right back. That, I think, just doesn't work. And then you have this creative class on both coasts, but especially in Hollywood and in the L.A. Basin, that is much more secular and much more liberal than the rest of America. And to them, a lot of this does look more normal. Let's go to Johnny calling from Lakeland, Florida, listening on WTBN. Welcome, Johnny.
Yeah, hello. I just wanted to tell you that, one, I didn't even watch this thing. I didn't care to. You know, if you're going to show my Lord in a certain type of light that isn't him, I'm not going to waste my time. I mean, I'm not going to argue against it either because they're going to do it anyway. But the ratings, I believe any ratings that they do have are going to plummet because a lot of people, I feel, watched it out of curiosity because of the controversy. So I think we're going to see this show go away. You know, I don't think it's going to last.
Well, I agree with you there, Johnny. As a matter of fact, I was just talking to our production staff. We were kind of conjecturing how many episodes we think this thing is going to go. And my guess is you're talking less than half a dozen. I can't imagine it going beyond this. I mean, it's hard enough for any show to make it. But when you get this kind of publicity and you still come in third on your opening night on a two-hour pilot, then America is saying, we don't even find this interesting. So what happens is this program becomes a window into looking at television and at the people that put television together and at the media elite who make these decisions rather than about America. You know, frankly, America, you have to look at this widespread grassroots America. We as a civilization and society, we have our problems. But I don't think there are that many families that can connect to this story and say, hey, I feel a resonance with this. And I think that's why it came in third out of three. We'll see just how determined NBC is to keep this on the air, and we're going to find out the answer to that question quite quickly. I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Neil Postman, in his book Amusing Ourselves to Death, talks about how we as a civilization have really accommodated ourselves to very low expectations in terms of the media. For one thing, we want to be amused, and that's why Americans turn on television. There are actually very few Americans who turn on television because they want to be informed. And there are even fewer because they want to be inspired. It's because they want to be simply entertained. And television can provide that, but it provides it in perhaps the world's worst way, in a way that is not morally demanding in general terms of the viewer, in a way that does not require much discernment. It doesn't even require much imagination. And because of that, you have the sensationalism of television and the phenomenon that is often referred to by the "and now this" phenomenon that has to do even with TV news. And now this, and now this, and now this. You can watch a sitcom one moment, and then you can watch a serious drama the next, and you can round it all out with the news and then one of the late-night entertainment programs, and round it out with an infomercial in which you can get the latest kitchen appliance along with a free set of knives. That's what television does to meaning. And so at the first level, I just want to suggest that Christians ought not to have inappropriate expectations about television. We shouldn't expect that television is going to be a great medium for evangelization. We should not expect that television is going to be a great medium for conveying the kind of meaning that is most important to us. It's not going to replace the preaching of the Word of God, and it's not even going to replace the conversation that Christians will have both with other believers and with non-Christians. Television sometimes will offend, as is the case with the book of Daniel. And it's very hard, actually, to see this as anything other than an intentional attempt to offend Christians. But I think it's also something of a send-up or a satire on liberal Christianity. And if you want to see the kind of result that you will get when you abandon the faith for something that is more or less just social Christianity, just situated within a therapeutic framework, well, this is it. Just listen to Pastor Webster's opening sermon, and you get just about everything you need to know what's going on. If he genuinely believes what he said, and of course we're talking about a character in this drama, when he says, don't fight temptation, but embrace it, the only thing you have to worry about is forgiving yourself, then maybe it's important for Americans to see where that leads, to the gay son and the fornicating son and the bishops that are all kinds of trouble and the Vicodin-popping priest himself. Most offensive in this storyline is Jesus, who appears as anything but the Christ of the Scriptures. Well, those who have suggested that the show's going to fail, I think, are probably on the right track. But while something like this is a part of our cultural conversation, it's a good thing for us to be thoughtful and intelligent in responding to it. I appreciate your calls. We'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.